You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. visited places around the United States in 1963, it was always an event. But Dr. King's arrival in Detroit in June of that year, with the speech he delivered to more than 100,000 people, was an important foretelling of things to come.
You develop in a conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they're worth dying for.
Dr. King's time at the Detroit Walk to Freedom came several months before the famous March on Washington. And yet, this was the place where people would first hear some of the language and themes powering the iconic I Have a Dream speech, a speech that would galvanize the nation for change. We spoke with Detroit writer Ken Coleman, author of On This Day, African-American Life in Detroit. He also writes regularly for Michigan Advance. Ken, tell us, what was Dr. King doing in Detroit in 1963?
Dr. King frequently visited Detroit throughout the late 1950s and, of course, the 1960s. But 1963 was a very interesting year, both nationally and the civil rights fight, but also locally. There was an organization in Detroit formed only months before the June 1963 march called the Detroit Council for Human Rights. It was founded primarily by three African-American men in Detroit, Benjamin McFall, who is a prominent mortician. His family owned a funeral home. Second gentleman was the Reverend Albert Clegg, who later founded the Shrine of the Black Madonna Church. But the third founder of the Detroit Council for Human Rights was the Reverend C.L. Franklin. Mm. And of course, we know Reverend C.L. Franklin as being the dad of Aretha Franklin, the great soul singer.
Ever since I found the Christ, there's been something in my life.
But certainly in 1963, Reverend Franklin was a prominent figure in civil rights and really sort of a national figure in the civil rights movement and a very good friend of Dr. King's, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
The crowd roared, "Black power." Dr. King goes on to say, "Black power is now a part of the nomenclature of the national community. To some, it is downright frightening. To others, it heralds a new day of unity for black people."
In fact, when Dr. King would visit Detroit throughout the mid to late 50s and up until 1963 and after, whenever he would visit Detroit, he'd often have dinner at the Franklin home. And so the two gentlemen, C.L. Franklin and Martin Luther King Jr., were great friends. And as this Detroit Council of Human Rights sets out to have this major march and rally on June 23rd, 1963, as the council seeks to do that, Reverend C.L. Franklin, reaches out to his good friend, the Reverend Martin Luther King, to be a participant and the keynote speaker. And that's how that happened.
How would you describe what happenings in Detroit represented with respect to the movement in the rest of the country at that time?
Sure. It's a great question. 1963 was a pivotal year. If you look at the landscape of the city of Detroit in that year, African Americans made up about 35% to 40% of the city's population, of Detroit's population. But they weren't reflected in a lot of organizations and institutions, both in the public and private sector. For example, African Americans made up less than 5% of the sworn police officers in Detroit. And that was a real issue, particularly when it came down to police community relations, feeling in the black community that far too many times African Americans were harassed by white police officers. And so that was sort of the setting in terms of police community relations. But the local branch NAACP for several years had been picketing, targeting businesses, banks, grocery stores in the city for their dreadful hiring practices in terms of not hiring African Americans for any jobs, let alone key positions. And so it was a real pivotal time. And on June 12th, 1963, several days before the Walk for Freedom March, Medgar Evers, a major NAACP leader in Mississippi, was murdered.
In a vacant lot about 40 yards away, a sniper fired a single shot from a high-powered rifle at Evers' silhouette.
All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom.
The bullet hit him in the back, crashed through his body, through a window into the house.
As you feel the pains of dogs here in Greenwood, we'll feel them in Jackson. We're going to win this fight for freedom. Thank you very much.
He died within an hour at a Jackson hospital.
The city of Jackson offers $5,000 reward to anyone who gives evidence leading to the arrest and the conviction of the guilty.
That was some of the backdrop going into the June 23rd Walk for Freedom March in Detroit.
It sounds like an incredibly dramatic moment.
No question about it.
So who was with Dr. King and Reverend Franklin on that day on the walk?
It was a who's who of leaders throughout Detroit proper and the state, and they included UAW President Walter Reuther.
And that we're going to build that solidarity to encompass every American, regardless of race or creed or color.
Former Governor John Swainson, Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh.
We had made really no national commitment on the part of the public or the Congress to really start to rebuild our cities, not just physically, but socially as well.
To be sure, in fact, Mayor Kavanaugh was instrumental in making sure that the permit process for the rally and the march and rally were able to be carried out. So the city government played a role with the Detroit Council for Human Rights and getting the Walk for Freedom going. Two sort of interesting individuals, or at least organizations that weren't represented at the 63 March in Detroit, were Governor George Romney. Governor Romney was a devout Mormon and almost never participated in activities on the Sabbath, on Sunday, that the march was carried out on. So the governor of the state, George Romney, was not there. Missing in action was the Detroit branch NAACP. The NAACP at that time was a little bit more of a conservative organization, certainly more conservative than the Detroit Council for Human Rights, and did not participate. In fact, Arthur Johnson, who is the secretary director at the time, wrote many years later in his memoir, he watched the marchers go into downtown Detroit, into Cobo Hall. He watched it from the rooftop of Cobo and did not participate in the march and then the culmination, the rally in Cobo Arena.
Do you know if he regretted that?
I think there was a degree of regret, to be sure. He went on to continue to have a strong presence in Detroit civil rights and civil rights across the nation. And I think he would call that a missed opportunity.
It's very interesting that there was representation among Michigan's mainstream politicians, in addition to the A-listers of the civil rights movement at that time. Do you think that represents the temperature of Detroit at that moment, or more the context of everything else that was happening in the country?
Certainly, Detroit has been a leader in the area of civil and human rights, to be sure. I mean, we certainly look at the civil rights movement as having its, headquarters, if you will, in the South. But here in Detroit, activists in Detroit participated in many movements, some more conservative than others, some more radical than others. It would not be a surprise to observers at the time that Detroit would host a rally and march that attracted 125,000 people.
The Walk to Freedom was designed in part to recognize the inequalities in labor and society that existed in the North rather than just the blatant racism within a segregationist South. How was that message received in Detroit and in the metro region?
It was received well. It covered locally and nationally. What's interesting about the Walk for Freedom is that, particularly, and you only have to look to the founders of the Detroit Council for Human Rights, to sort of have this illustrated and crystallized. each of them had really their own agenda. They were all African-American men, McFaul, Clegg, and Franklin, but they were on different sort of spectrums of, you know, the ideological landscape when it comes to civil rights. Mm-hmm. Clegg eventually would found a nationalist, a black nationalist religious sect in the Shrine of the Black Madonna within several years after the march. Franklin was more mainstream, but certainly was to the left of national organizations like the NAACP. McFaul was a business leader, certainly interested in civil rights, but certainly had sort of an economic, was interested in economic independence for African Americans, or at least economic advancement. And so they represented different ideological positions, which I think caused a lot of people to kind of get in where they could fit in. The march attracted 125,000 people, but they weren't probably all people that agreed on every, you know, every aspect of the civil rights fight. And I think that's what made the march, you know, very interesting. And certainly one of the larger marches in Detroit history. A couple months later, the nation watches at the March on Washington. But really, Detroit was the real forerunner for that March on Washington in August of 1963.
The words may be very similar, but it feels like there might have been different contexts for hearing that speech with 125,000 people in Detroit in May of that year and hearing it with the massive crowd in Washington, D.C. in August. What message was Dr. King trying to convey that day in Detroit?
A couple of things. One, certainly demanding, really, at that point, that the American government respect African Americans and advance civil rights legislation. But the other really kind of dealt with the sort of societal inequities that really carried themselves out in terms of employment opportunities for African Americans. Really sort of that economic advancement and that, you know, that piece of the pie. So really sort of a two-pronged demand, if you will.
We'll be done. Trouble of the world.
The story goes that Mahalia Jackson was the one who encouraged Dr. King to give the dream speech in Washington, D.C. Do you know if he had intended to use what he'd said in Detroit at the March on Washington before that point?
It's a great question, and as it's been asked before, I haven't found research that would make the point that King consciously sort of used Detroit as a sort of training ground, if you will, for the I Have a Dream speech. There were elements of King's speeches that over time we've seen that were used in several opportunities. That nothing that I've been able to research suggests that it was a conscious decision to do I Have a Dream in Detroit, or whether or not there was an individual or individuals that encouraged him to offer the oratory that he did.
And such things are possible in a pre-internet world where you can work on a speech over time in that way.
Absolutely. And if you can imagine, Martin Luther King by 1963 was in high demand, and, you know, probably 250 days out of a 365-day year, he was on the road, if you will, offering his support in civil rights endeavors and probably working on speeches and oratory piece by piece and putting things together depending on where he was in the nation and what the issue was that day.
Ken, thank you for taking some time on this with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Who can say it better than Dr. King himself? Let's listen to a bit of that historic speech from Detroit in June of 1963.
And I do not want to give you the impression that it's going to be easy. There can be no great social gain without individual pain. Before the victory for brotherhood is won, some will have to get scarred up a bit. Before the victory is won, some more will be thrown into jail. Before the victory is won, some, like Medgar Evers, may have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children and their white brothers from an eternal psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names. But we must go on with a determination and with a faith that this problem can be solved. And so I go back to the South not in despair. I go back to the South not with a feeling that we are caught in a dark dungeon that will never lead to a way out. I go back believing that the new day is coming. And so this afternoon I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day, right down in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to live together as brothers. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, little white children and little Negro children will be able to join hands as brothers and sisters. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, men will no longer burn down houses in the Church of God simply because people want to be free. I have a dream this afternoon that there will be a day that we will no longer face the atrocities that Emmett Till had to face or Medgar Evers had to face, but that all men can live with dignity. I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. Yes, I have a dream this afternoon that one day in this land the words of Amos will become real. Justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I have a dream this evening that one day we will recognize the words of Jefferson that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have a dream this afternoon. I have a dream this afternoon that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day. With this faith, I will go out and carve a tunnel of hope through the mountain of despair. With this faith, I will go out with you and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. With this faith, we will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of old, free at last,